This week's Parsha is called Kitisa, our 21st Parsha. Congratulations, you guys are all making it this far. And the title of the class is A Practical Guide to Battle Satan. Okay, so we're going to start, as we always do, we're going to start with a video. So I'm going to go with a screen share. And here we go. Here we go.
Similar, you know, people say same corporation, different division. We get along. There's an obvious, you know, thing with the religion. I went to my first Passover dinner. My mother's gonna have Passover. We'll go to the dinner. 7:30, we sit down at her mother's house. I'm starving, right? Starving. Passing out pamphlets like reading material. What's going on? What are we doing here? What's with the... I know we read for 2 hours. 2 hours. I said, listen, I'm going to tell you, as soon as I sit at the table, I got to have bread within 15 seconds of sitting down. All right? I need something to do with my right hand. I need a... Is there some oil coming out? Is that oil? I need oil. Now. Hungry. And they food, the food they start bringing out, oh God, terrible, terrible. Jews have no idea what the hell they're doing in the kitchen. These people have no cuisine. Celery, crackers, jam. I'm like, what is it? We're losing. People are leaving. We need food. After breakfast, they fall apart. The Jews. After a bagel, cream cheese, lox, where are they going? They got nothing. They have nothing. Has anybody ever said to you, we went to this Jewish restaurant last night? The gefilte, amazing. I respect the Jews, but let's just have the Italians cater to Passover meal. All right? For a couple of hours with some meatballs on the table.
All right. That's Sebastian Mascalco. Very funny guy.
I've seen that skit a few times in the past.
Yeah, it's a classic.
Yeah.
Classic. The winner. Now, of course, the next question is, what did I do with the Parsha? Actually, nothing. I just liked that video. I just wanted to share that with you. No.
And we'll see you next week. Thank you.
Right, and that's it. Now, here we go. Here we go. So, all right. Bring it a little more practical. How many people feel like, now, Sebastian, obviously, a Catholic, Italian, but how many people feel like Sebastian about the 2 hours of reading materials at the Seder? What do you guys say?
Most people.
Yeah, that seems pretty familiar.
Right. Okay.
I don't feel that way anymore, but.
No, but the thing is that he was broadsided by that. Like, he's going over I think he's married to a Jew. He's going over to his mother-in-law's house for a Seder, and he had no idea. Well, he calls it a Passover meal. He doesn't even know the word Seder. And he's like, had no idea what was happening. He just got, you know, they just handed him a Haggadah, you know.
That's the best way to get somebody in there. You just throw
100%, no uptight, you know. And here's some reading material, which we're now going to read for the next 2 hours. All right. So, which gets to question number two, what conflict does it usually create?
Sorry, come again?
What conflicts does this usually create when you have people there who pretty much, they want to eat the Seder, the quote-unquote, the reading material is of little to no interest to them? What conflict does it create at the Pesach Seder?
Well, you can get some passive-aggressive adults who start talking, and some want to hear, some don't, some want to eat, some get up, start getting stuff.
Yeah, I guess it would be a matter of distraction.
All right, you're gonna get the super aggressive people like give you this sign. Does everybody know this universal sign that I'm doing?
Wrap it up.
Is keep it moving, buddy. We're starving over here. We're dying. Okay. Then you have the passive aggressive one, like they'll start making comments. So let's say a section is red. And somebody says, I ask a question about it. And they give them the dirty look like you're asking a question. You're prolonging the freaking agony here. We have a simple goal. We are on page 4. Eating's on page 48. The goal is to get from A to Z in the quickest possible way. You, my friend, are adding time to our arrival at page 48, a.k.a. dinner time. Okay, so they're starting, you'll start getting the remarks. All right, let's, is there any of the material that we can, shall we say, skip or just scan with our eyes? You'll have some sort of conflict. And then the people who are like super into it, get annoyed at them, and you'll have the people who feel more righteous. What do you mean? It's a great mitzvah, blah, blah, blah. And the other people say, I'm starving. I didn't have lunch today. I forgot about that, whatever. I was at my office. I was very busy. And typically when you get Jewish families together, most times there's going to be either an overt fight or a covert fight. Is that seem a reasonable assessment to you or an unreasonable assessment to you?
Yeah, 100%.
100%. You'll get the covert fights if you have people who are much more, they're more diplomatic or more mild, but the aggression is going to leak out. It just can't. There's a reason that the family doesn't get together all that often. Okay? Because they like it that way. If they love spending a lot of time with each other, they would. If they don't, they come in. This is the minimally socially acceptable time to get together. This Seder for a Jewish family is a requirement until you go down to absolute dysfunction. Okay? Is that clear? All right.
110%.
Okay. We're on the same page. We go to question number 3. Why does the same fight happen every year? This is a very interesting thing. It's not that people fight. It's literally the same fight, different year. Why isn't there any change? I lay that question before this august panel of wise people. So first of all, is that assessment, first of all, before you find that to be the case? Is it that not only that people fight, but it's the same fights?
I mean, it's either the same fight or, people just kind of sit around the table slowly simmering away until the very end, and then everybody leaves and, must have a drink in order to calm down and go to sleep or something, right?
Oftentimes the same fights with the same people.
Right, right.
Now I ask you, why is this happening? Why isn't there any change?
Why is it people aren't maturing from year to year so that the fights aren't different?
Okay.
Or they were never resolved in the first place, so the next time you see them in the same circumstance, you just go right back to where you left off.
Okay. So now. Let's say, for example, we don't know what exactly happened when Sebastian Maniscalco went to his first Pesach Seder. you know, he was trying to be polite, but, you know, let's say he did not, at best, he probably only, you know, I don't think he, you know, got aggressive. He just probably made a lot of jokes because he's a comedian. Joke making is a form of passive aggressiveness. So what Shmuel is arguing is that basically people are, A, the way they are, A, internally their personality makes little to no change. Therefore, when the same ingredients or the same people are in the same situation, the reaction is going to be identical. So based upon that, what would be the solution to that problem?
Disinvite one different person every year.
All right, so one way to avoid the conflict is not to have the combatant present.
Sure.
Okay, that's one solution. What else do we got?
To actually find a lasting solution of maturational change.
Okay, but you can't control the other person.
It's
hard enough to control ourselves. Controlling others is even more hard, if not impossible.
So the alternative, I guess, is to make the material such that it diffuses conflict somehow.
Well, before that, the first step of dealing with a conflict is to identify what are the factors, you know, why is this happening? Okay, oftentimes you have in a family dynamic, there could be a power struggle, okay? And the person is reacting because they feel unempowered, and therefore they have to act even more aggressively. In other words, the issue is not a fight over Pesach or eating more, eating less, early, later. It oftentimes, the anger gets into the fact that, oh, you're trying to force your religion down my throat. That's one aggressive way of interpreting. Or, you know, you're always telling me what to do. Or, you know, you'll get lines like that. If you take away some of peel away some of the skin here, you start to see what the fundamental dynamics is. If the issue is that if the Seder feels too hierarchical, one guy in charge, bossing everybody around to do activities that they don't really like. So one solution is what, obviously? And this is just a good Pesach Seder. We're coming up, you know, a month and a couple of days. It's a good strategy with every Seder anywhere, no matter where you are in the world. What's way to solve that problem?
Based on what you're saying, it sounds like you could either delineate certain areas of activity or give different people tasks to do to get more people involved.
The way to deal with a conflict oftentimes is to be aware of the conflict, anticipate the conflict, and neutralize it in advance. So if you know there's a power struggle, one solution, of course, is, well, we're going to have people take different parts of the Seder and they have to explain it. So you're going to do pages 40 to 44. Would you like to do that? Are you comfortable to doing that? In order to divide up the jobs. So therefore, you're not saying that you're the boss. Everybody's working to make it a democratic experience. Second point, just in the practical sense, if people are going to come in there starving and therefore they're just not in the head to listen to anything, there's nothing wrong after you make kiddush of putting some, let's call it, hors d'oeuvre level kind of food out. You know what I'm saying?
Appetizers.
Yeah, in other words, like what they call a tapas style. Like you'll have a little bowl with like a meatball, a little bowl with like a piece of kugel or some sort of potato blend. In other words, you're not supposed to have your meal before you discuss the essential story, but to have some you know, appetizers, small appetizers that sort of take off the edge, if you will, is logically fine. You know what I'm saying? So you already neutralized the problem. You don't even tell them. You put it on the table. Boom. Skadoosh. Problem solved. Okay? So, because if you know, because there are people come to the Savior, they're not hungry. They're hangry. You guys know the difference between hungry and hangry?
Not having a Snickers bar.
That not having a Snickers bar. In other words, you're so hungry that you're angry. It's hangry. And if a person's hangry, their mind is shut down because they're dealing with the lowest common denominator issue, is that physiologically they're in a state of want. So if you don't address that, they can't handle it.
So I would By the way, Snickers not kosher for Pesach.
What?
Snickers not kosher for Pesach.
Snickers not kosher, but I'm saying, but there's a little plenty. No Jew has lost weight over Pesach, so there's plenty of good kosher food to put out on the table. So that's the deal. Now, let me ask you this question. Question number 4. What other areas of life does occur? Namely, the same issues with the same people in the same way. For example, children and parents, siblings, husband and wife, or boyfriend and girlfriend, in-laws and couples. Give me a couple of the top ones on the board here. What do you think? Give me a classic issue, fight, if you will, between the same people or fighting about the same issue in the same way. And it's like a Groundhog Day situation.
Yeah, it could be definitely children and parents, you know, cleaning your room, not cleaning the room, doing the homework.
Well, it's the same fight every night or every day. Correct. That's a classic one. Excellent. Now, why isn't there any change?
Because, I mean, really, the parent doesn't know how to deal with the child.
Correct. Because what tool is the parent using? He's got one tool to deal with the problem.
Well, the only tool it seems like parents use these days is authority. I'm the parent. I'm bigger, and I'm telling you what to do.
Right. So that they're just using the power of authority, the weight of authority on the child to conform to the parent's wishes. Now, there is a time and place for that. If a child who's 6 years old is about to run into the street, you're not going to have a conversation with them. You know what I'm saying? But there's, you know what I'm saying, there's a time for that. But, there, you know, obviously, if a person's getting, as you've heard the phrase, the definition of insanity is doing the exact same thing and expecting different results. So Shmuel, it's a good example. How about between siblings? And how about between boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wives? Give me a couple of classic ones. Come on, Shane.
Between spouses could be one who leaves their clothing on the floor and doesn't clean up after themselves.
That argument could go on for decades. Decades.
Hopefully with different articles of clothing.
Yeah, because it typically what makes that argument can oftentimes go into a that harm, you know, because if the woman's typically the woman's going to be upset about the clothes on the floor, by and large, she's going to interpret that as being, you're throwing the clothes on the floor, so you're reducing me, that my role is what? I'm your personal maid. I'm your slave. Which is quickly followed by B, that you don't really appreciate what I do in the house. As the fact that you see that I'm cleaning out the house and all you're doing is leaving your junk all over the place. Right? Sound familiar? Right. So therefore, but then it can escalate up and then, well, you're always hawking me and you're scolding me. And then it becomes an argument of each one imputing the other person's character. You are always like this and you are always like that. And then you have fundamentally a meltdown. and the foundations of the relationship start to deteriorate. You know what I'm saying? But there's no growth. So why is it? So we go back to our same principle here. There is no growth because a person has this sort of childlike feeling that the way that I am is the way that I am, and I like the way that I am, and I don't like to change, and I'm not interested in trying to fix the problem. I'll just go back to the same. It's remarkable how people will get to the same fight all the time without trying to step back and say, how can I really solve this? You know what I'm saying? It's sort of shocking. Why isn't there any kind of movement here? They don't like getting yelled at. They don't like slamming doors. How come there's very little, what are some of the reasons why they see the pain is causing in their life. Well, why don't they change or try to work out a solution? Suzanne, what do you think?
I think part of the thing is we have to change our perception of things. So we don't, and we ascribe these...
Main class.
We ascribe these thoughts and actions, these feelings to... So leaving clothes on the floor, I'm the maid, so... They have to change their perception in order to help change that dynamic. Because like you were saying, you can't change another person, so you have to change your perception. But people aren't doing that. I always kind of bring things back to a lack of insight on our part.
Right, so why not? But I want to go a little deeper. Why are people not perceiving that? Why do you think? So why are they not changing their perception? Why are they not trying to figure out the inner dynamic? Why are they not trying to get expert opinion? Why are they not trying to learn about the area of human psychology? What's going on? How do you explain this?
One thing, I think they don't know how to go about that.
Okay.
That's one thing.
With Suzanne, at one point is that nobody ever really trained them how to solve these interpersonal problems. It's a skill set. They don't have no idea what to do. That's one problem. What other things are they missing?
Well, they believe they're right.
So why are they still, in other words, if they're getting the same reaction, which is unpleasant, and in fact, as going to reference what Mendel said, many people in anticipation of family get-together, not limited to Pesach, literally will either A, it's like a joke in our culture, like there's Uncle Bob at Thanksgiving getting drunk. Now, why is a person getting drunk? Because the pain of being fully sober and conscious of what's occurring is so painful, the person needs to self-medicate immediately. I need to leave. Now, I can't leave physically. I'm just going to leave, but I'm still going to be here on the couch. You know what I'm saying? In 3 beers from now, I'll be mostly out the door. 4, I'm going to be horizontal. All right? So that's really, they're hiding from the problem. So this is in every family we see this. What's the problem? Why is there so little progress? All right, it's a little bit of a shocker if you think about it.
I mean, it's a big problem. It has several different facets, but it seems like one of them could be the idea that people think that their perception, maybe as Suzanne was saying, is right, is correct, and that there is no real insight or questioning of their own perception, of their own ideas that, maybe I have the wrong idea about something.
Okay.
Maybe I have to be curious and go out and ask a question or consider that my opinion could be completely wrong, that my perspective could be completely wrong.
Right. All right. So we're gonna circle back to that because this conversation is actually relevant to one of the, in a certain sense, I would call one of the more shocking episodes in the entire Tanakh, which of course is the sin of the golden calf. Because here we have the Jewish people left Egypt, gathered around Mount Sinai, had a revelation, heard God, had either, you know, we can, you know, either they had a prophetic insight themselves, or God created a voice where they heard the Ten Commandments. Everybody will, the narrative tells us that they were overwhelmed by the experience. Moshe then comes back and tells them the Mishpatim, all right, three chapters of civil law. They say Nasa Venishma. They say we're going to be. They do their final step of their conversion. There's an offering done. And then they become the Jewish people. Moshe goes up the mountain, and he's gone for 40 days. And as we're going to soon read, a complete meltdown. All right? So, like, what happened? How's that possible? All right. Let's take a look. All right. So let's have Shayna read it out.
Meanwhile, the people began to realize that Moshe was taking a long time to come down from the mountain. They gathered around Aharon and said to him, "Make us an oracle, Elohim, to lead us." We have no idea what.
No, it's not. Well, it's not a holy name because it's some sort of either an idol or something. Or the way that Rabbi Kaplan is translating, an oracle was sort of like an object that can channel power, like sort of like a crystal, you know, like a new age crystal kind of thing. All right, go on.
We have no idea what happened to Moshe, the man who brought us out of Egypt. "Take the rings off the ears of your wives and children," replied Aharon. "Bring them to me." All the people took off their earrings and brought them to Aharon. He took the rings from the people and had someone form the gold in a mold, casting it into a calf. Some of the people began to say, "This, Israel, is your God who brought you out of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before the calf. Aharon made an announcement and said, "Tomorrow there will be a festival to God." Getting up early the next morning, the people sacrificed burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. The people sat down to eat and drink, and then got up to enjoy themselves.
Okay, so this is the episode. Then the next scene, of course, is God tells Moshe what's occurring to his people at the base of the mountain. Okay, so what are some of the questions here?
Aaron seems really complicit in all of it.
This is the biggest shocker. This is the number two shocker of the entire episode. Here we have Aaron, who is a prophet.
Brother to Moshe.
He's Moshe's brother who seems to be facilitating their idolatrous activity. And as you know later on in the story, not only does he not get punished, he gets the position of the Kohen Gadol. He gets promoted. What's going on over here? So that's another shocking element here. You know, as a prophet of God, he should have, you know, instead of being a facilitator of idolatry of some sort, he should have said, "No, I'm not going to do it." And then if he had to take the sword, he should have taken the sword. I mean, because they just heard the second commandment is there should be no other gods before me. He's the de facto leader, and they're pushing towards some sort of, you know, the question is what exactly were they asking for? There's a big debate about that. We'll touch upon a little bit. And he should have just said no. He should have, you know, shut them down. And if it would have meant, you know, having a harsh consequence, he should have taken it. But no, he's like orchestrating the whole thing. All right, okay, here's a plan. All right, gather all the gold, and we're gonna we'll make the calf. All right, tomorrow we're gonna have a festival. So this is, how could a prophet of God be a facilitator of idolatry? And then only that, he doesn't get punished. And B, he becomes the agent, the agent of the national service, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. That's a big shocker. So there's two big questions is, how could these people just fall? They had a revelation. They had a tremendous transcendent clarity 40 days earlier. And now they're back to doing what they did in Egypt. It's just a shocker. So as you can well imagine, there is a ton of material on this topic. So we can't, we got to be done by 9. So we're not going to do all the positions. We're going to do one tonight, Rashi, because he gives us some of the midrashim, which can be helpful to understand some of the psychological mechanisms. All right, let's take it out. All right, so let's have. All right, let's read out Shana. Keep on going.
That Moses was late, or Hebrew vashesh, as the Targum Onkelos renders ochar. An expression for lateness. Likewise, in the verse, is his chariot late, Basis, and they waited until it was late, Basis.
You show that the word Boshesh means he was late, he was delayed. Okay, go on.
And they waited until it was late, Bosh. When Moses went up the mountain, he said to them, the Israelites, at the end of 40 days, I will come, within 6 hours.
By the way, hold on, factually, this is not recorded in the Torah. This is Rashi is bringing down in Midrash to communicate that. But go on. So this is the Midrash speaking. It's not in the actual text. Go on.
At the end of 40 days, I will come within 6 hours from sunrise of the 40th day. They thought that the day he meant was included in the number of the 40 days, but in fact, he had said to them 40 days, meaning complete days, including the night. But the day of his ascent did not have its night included with it, because Moses ascended in the morning. For on the 7th of Sivan he ascended. Thus, the 40th day of Moses' absence was the 17th of Tammuz. On the 16th of Tammuz, Satan came and brought confusion into the world and showed a semblance of darkness, even pitch darkness and confusion, as if indicating that Moses had surely died, and therefore confusion had come upon the world. Satan said to them, Moses has died, for 6 additional hours have already passed, and he has not come, etc., as found in Tractate Shabbat. We cannot say that the Israelites' only error was that on a cloudy day they were confused between before noon and afternoon, because Moses did not descend until the next day. As it is said, on the next day, they arose early, offered up burnt offerings.
Okay, let's read another one. Next, Rashi.
Because this man Moses, Satan showed them something resembling Moses, being carried in the air, high above in the sky, who brought us up from the land of Egypt and directed us the way we should go up from Egypt. Now we need gods who will go before us instead of Moses.
Excellent. Okay, all right, so I'm gonna pause right there. We'll get to the Aaron point. So, all right, so what is challenging about Rashi?
I mean, he seems to reduce it to a matter of timing, like they all of a sudden 600,000 people forgot how to count when Moshe went up and when he came down and when he was supposed to return, etc.
All right, so fine. So let's say it's a scheduling error. So why are they not saying, all right, you know, we all get something now. We make a meeting from 2 to 3, and sometimes the meeting drags.
I mean, I'm sure there's an element of fear there, considering how important Moshe certainly was to all of those people, and especially what they had just gone through. For him to not return at the scheduled time must have brought about a tremendous amount of anxiety and fear to all of those people.
Excellent.
And so there's a void there to be filled.
This is not like at work when, you know, you had a meeting scheduled for 4 and the people supposed to show up, you know, don't show up. Okay. It's not typical, you know, lateness in the office when the meeting's supposed to schedule. As Shmuel is pointing out rightfully, where are they? They are in the wilderness. They're away from, a civilized society. Their leader has gone away for a month and a half. The day he's supposed to come has gone and went. And so they're basically, they're freaking out. Okay, now, but Rashi adds something which is very interesting between those two Rashis.
He adds in Satan, this character that we don't have otherwise.
Well, the word Satan is actually mentioned in the Tanakh. He's a character by the book of Job. Okay, so so what's our first question?
What is this Satan representing, or what is it?
Good. What is Satan? What is Satan? That's the first question.
Isn't that just the evil inclination?
Is it the inclination? Yes, it is. We're going to get to that. So number one, it's the evil inclination. We'll talk about that. Yes. So, but that's the first question. But then, what's the second question?
What is it that he showed them that actually caused the problem?
Correct. All right. So those are two problems. The problem is, why is the timing factor so monumental? Shmuel saying, well, obviously it's not just a simple missing of an appointment. They're feeling tremendous anxiety. He's their leader, and they're freaking out without him. That's the point number one. Point number two is Rashi indicates Satan. Satan does two things. He makes confusion in the world, darkness, and then the next Rashi is that they see him, they visualize him, that Moshe is sort of like carried off into the in the clouds over there. He's going away. Okay, so what? And therefore, we need other gods. All right, so we have to get to that. Now let's get to the Aaron question. Go on.
That are on the ears of your wives. Aaron said to himself, the women and children are fond of their jewelry. Perhaps the matter will be delayed, and in the meantime, Moses will arrive. But they did not wait for their wives and children to give them their earrings, and they took off their own earrings.
Can I go on?
When Aaron saw that it was alive, as it is said, for the likeness of an ox eating grass, and he saw that Satan's work had succeeded, and he had no words to stall them completely, i.e. to keep the Israelites from worshiping the calf, so then he built an altar to stall them, and said, tomorrow shall be a festival to the Lord, but it will not be today. Perhaps Moses would come before they would worship it. This is its simple meaning.
All right, so the Rashi, this is the classic approach, which doesn't answer the question fully, but it's a very important beginning. Our own strategy is not that he's a weak leader who's just giving in to the wishes of the people. He's trying to recognize that in damage control, he's in a leadership role of damage control. How could I mitigate the situation? Can I have a conversation with hysterical people about why this is insane to build the golden calf? No, that will not work. He's trying to be involved in it. So he tried a number of strategies to delay them. And once they saw Moshe, their issues would basically evaporate. Okay, that was a strategy. Now, there's a lot to discuss here. And again, what Sean pointed out is actually the Talmud and Bava Basra says, Satan is the evil incarnation, is the angel in death. Hu Satan, hu Yetzer Hara, hu Malach HaMavet. Which means, in contrast to a Christian perspective, we don't view Satan as a little creature on our shoulder, even though like in cartoons, remember we always watch cartoons and little Satan with a little pitchfork is on the guy's right or left ear and then telling them what to do. Really, the Satan, which Satan means literally means to divert, means to twist, to pervert. Satan is the part of our being. The Yetzer Hara basically is the instinctual part of man. That part of man that wants immediate gratification regardless of the consequences. You can also identify it as being really what? Your inner child. Your inner child wants immediate gratification without any kind of consequences. Right? So that's the deal. Here's my key question to you guys. Let's see if we can work this out. This is where there's a Why wasn't Aaron afraid and hysterical about Moshe's lateness?
Because he was a matured individual. It wasn't, I don't imagine it was every single individual there who was clamoring for the golden calf. It wasn't every single one of them.
Well, I mean, I can't do the whole story. You see that God wants to destroy the entire Jewish people. So you have to say that, which is another question, is that the majority of the Jews are involved on some level, either psychologically, on some level, validating the golden calf project, because what are they not doing?
Not doing it.
Well, they're not stopping those people who are pushing for it. In other words, there's not a debate. Like, nobody's saying, "Hey guys, this is crazy. Let's discuss this." Now, interesting enough, at the end of the story, you'll see. You know, this chapter has 35 verses. It took a minute. Only 3,000 people get killed in execution as punishment. There's 600,000 Jews. It's a very small fraction. So so there's different levels of involvement. Why are they not?
Does the whole nation get condemned to wander the desert for 40 years, though?
No.
This isn't that story.
What story is that?
Oh, no, that's the 12 Meraglim. I'm sorry.
Right. The sin of the Meraglim of the spies condemns the Jews to have to spend 40 years in the desert. This one, God wants to destroy the Jews in Moshe, which is another interesting.
Praise for them.
Praise for them, intercede for them, and that's not. Which is a question about, you know, doesn't God know this already? If they were worthy of death, they should get nailed. And if they're not, then why is he threatening it? Did he need Moshe's gesture to remind him not to do it? That's another class. But I'm just at least stating the question. You know, I'm giving you other some additional, questions.
Teasers.
A little partial teaser action. But focus on why was it Aaron afraid and hysterical about Moshe's lateness? Or does he like being left with all the Jewish people in the desert? I mean, he doesn't have a cell phone where he can speak to Moshe. He's in a worse situation. He's actually stuck being the de facto leader with a nation who's hysterical. And he's not afraid.
Well, it doesn't really speak to his state of mind or his level of anxiety, but clearly his rational faculty was in charge. He didn't let whatever feelings he may or may not have had get to him.
Well, and the proof is, especially the way Rashi is presenting it, he had a plan. He was working out his plan. It was not going well. But he was still calm enough.
Yeah, he had a backup plan as well, apparently.
He was trying all things to basically, his solution was mitigate the damage until Moshe shows up and then the problem will go away. Okay. Now, so I want to circle back to the Satan point. Okay. We'll get back to understand their state of mind. So it says there's two statements. One is that Satan came and brought confusion into the world and showed a semblance of darkness, even pitch darkness and confusion. What does that mean? If you understand that Satan is not an extraneous phenomena, but really describing their internal world, now look at that midrash differently.
Yeah, to me, what I think of immediately when I hear that and read that is, it's a really poetic way of saying a wave of fear and anxiety and uncertainty washed over everyone who was there.
Correct. In other words, the darkness, it's like when a person gets completely, you put it in modern terminology, it's the way of the Midrash is describing that the Jews felt a sort of a depression, anxiety, all mixed together. So they're completely being rocked right now. But there's another little then that's not all. Then Satan showed them something resembling Moshe. They saw like a cloud, whatever, and they saw like Moshe's being carried off into the netherworld. What's up with that? How does that, in other words, the first one, I think, what Shmuel's saying is a good read of that Medrash. But there seems to be, they saw two things.
Well, I'm not sure that they're entirely disconnected.
They're not disconnected.
Right. Because as a result of the first part, they believe the second part.
But what is the second part? What is that?
That Moshe isn't coming back. He's gone. He's done. He's gone. He left us.
But why? But isn't that the anxiety of the first one? They saw, they're counting off the days. Obviously, they didn't feel this on day 20. But day 40, they're freaking out. It's a full freakout situation.
So there was a real event. Moshe is not there when they thought he was going to be. So that's a real event. Then they have anxiety as a result of that event that causes them to then in turn believe that he's never coming back.
Yeah, but then they say, but they saw this image and they say, oh, we need gods. We need many gods.
I'm not sure how that works.
All right, so I'm going to give you a possibility. We got 10 minutes left. The idea is, that this was an idea articulated by my Rashi Wright Shade. He said, really, they were feeling two emotions. The first emotion was Shmuel said. They felt a tremendous dread, anxiety. It's like, imagine you're a seven-year-old child. You're in the mall at the end of December, and there's a crush of people, and you're holding on to your parent's hand. And then you don't feel your parent, and you turn around, and all you see are the faces of strangers. And you look around, and you do not see your parent anymore. That is a very painful child experience of feeling abandoned. Very painful. Where's mommy? She's gone. They went back to a very primitive place. They felt abandoned. But then there's another thing. There's a part of them that, on one hand, they wanted Moshe. They felt confident with Moshe. But there's another element with Moshe. There's a part of the child that doesn't want their parent around. That is sort of happy when the parent leaves. In other words, there's two conflicting emotions. There's the parent's gone. Oh, my gosh, I'm abandoned. And the parent is leaving them. They feel a sense of there's a little bit of a joy. I'm free. I'm free from their control. So since they had this conflict, they were stuck in a conflicted state.
Does a 7-year-old really feel that?
I don't know. They're not feeling no. I'm not saying the 7-year-old feels it. I'm saying they are adults. Moshe, remember, Moshe is the lawgiver. He's giving them a new constitution. Their inner child is not loving everything that he has to say. Okay?
So they had competing emotions, you're saying.
And that sort of locked them into a very primitive state. Now, going back to my question before, which you guys basically answered, and this is really the solution to everything, is that Aaron did not feel this. Because Aaron was... is a wise person. I just want to read one more little small text and then we'll wrap everything up here. Let's take a look at, this is the Rambam talking about there's many laws against idolatry and magic and sorcery and divination, you know, strong, you know, all these kind of things. You may be familiar with that. All right, so let's have, so let me have Sean read it out.
All the above matters of falsehood and lies with which the original idolaters deceived the Gentile nations in order to lead them after them.
All right, so stop right there. So basically, the reason that the ancient world was big into magic and witchcraft and sorcery, etc., was typically used by the leadership, like Paro would have his magicians to basically control the people. It was a tool of political control. Okay, that's his theory. Go on.
It is not fitting for the Jews who are wise sages to be drawn into such emptiness, nor to consider that they have any value, as implied by Numbers 23:23. No fortune telling can be found among makeup or wizardry within Israel. Similarly, in Deuteronomy 18:14 states, these nations which you are driving out, listen to astrologers and diviners. This is not what God has granted you. Whoever believes in magic of this nature and in his heart think that they are true and words of wisdom are forbidden by the Torah is foolish and feeble-minded. The masters of wisdom and those of perfect knowledge know with clear proof that all these crafts which the Torah forbade are not reflections of wisdom, but rather emptiness and vanity, which attracted the feeble-minded and caused them to abandon all the paths of truth. For these reasons, when the Torah warned against all these empty matters, it advised in Deuteronomy 18:13, be of perfect faith with God your Lord.
Okay, so the Ram basically makes clear his argument is that basically not when the Torah forbids magic, fortune telling, divination, all the superstitious stuff. What is it basically the deal? The Torah doesn't forbid it because it's really true. It's really baloney. And what does a Jew have to view himself as being? What's their ego ideal? What's their idea that? What does the Ram say? Basically, we're supposed to be. What's our aspirational goal?
To be a wise sage.
To be a wise sage. So I get to the first question. What is the first step in being a wise person?
Learning.
More specific than that.
Removing idolatry from your life?
It's true, but how do you do that?
Belief in Hashem.
Okay. But there's something which is a little bit of that's true as well. It's interesting, on the entrance of the Lyceum, does anyone know what the Lyceum was?
Is that like some kind of Greek academy?
It was the Greek academy, which you had Plato, we had Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. For about 400 years, they had that was their yeshiva on philosophy. Okay? On the door, above the door, they had two words.
Know thyself.
Know thyself.
Okay? Not N-O, not N-O.
Right. In other words, have self-knowledge. The first step for knowledge is to have self-knowledge, be aware of your inner self. Okay?
Okay.
So let me develop that a little more. Okay? So, number three, how would it help solve conflict that Sebastian brought up? If you had, if the people around the Seder had self-knowledge, how would it avoid the problem that this poor Italian guy shows up and freaking out.
He would have planned better, and he.
Well, it's not his fault. He has no idea. No, it's not his fault. He never heard of a Seder. It's not his. I'm not blaming him because he doesn't know what the Seder is.
Yeah, they would have informed him of what the situation going forward is going to be.
Exactly, and therefore they would avoid the problem in advance. In other words,
2 hours.
Right, yeah. Therefore, because again, if Sebastian stopped by an Italian deli before hitting up the Seder and had himself a meatball hero, I don't want to be, he would have walked into the Seder, prepared, and then it would have been a much better experience, all right? Okay? Now, what is the focus of Proverbs, Ethics of Our Fathers, and the entire book of Bereishit?
Relationships?
A major focus is it tells us certain principles of ethical behavior between a man and his fellow, or you call it psychology. So basically what you need, the first ingredient and which the people at the Egel did not have was A, self-knowledge. What are the mechanisms, first of all, in general, what are the mechanisms of man in general? We call that psychology. What are the principles? That's expressed in Proverbs, Ethics of Our Fathers, the Book of Rations. The Book of Psychological Knowledge in general, outside of myself. Then, what are the psychological principles that's animating me? What are my issues? If I have, then, step three, what are the people around the table's issues? If I understand the principles of human behavior, if I understand the principles of my own world, my inner world, I have a sense of self-awareness. And step three, I understand the mechanisms that are animating the people around me. I am better equipped to say the right thing, do the right thing, and plan for everything. Now, it's interesting, in our tradition, who's known as the greatest interpersonal person, which is expressed more openly, you know, expressly in the oral law, in the Torah Baal Peh? Who in the Tanakh is viewed as the ultimate people person?
In Tanakh is the most...
Yeah.
Yosef?
Yosef's a good, that's a good guess. He was that. But there's one person who is heralded of having unbelievable skill set.
Is it Avram?
Avram is an excellent candidate because he engaged everybody, educated people of all walks of life. So you have to have a pretty amazing skill set to engage everybody and educate everybody. But in particular, insofar as conflict, it's really Aaron. Pirkei Avos says you should be of the disciples of Aaron, who Bakei Shalom veRodef Shalom. He sought peace and chased down peace. So basically, he had strategies to deal with people who are feuding and try to ameliorate the problems, engage with both people, and get them back together. He's able to bring people back together. Which is, as you all know, is an incredibly, a very difficult skill set. Now, in order to do that, you have to have a tremendous inner sensitivity to human dynamic. You know what I mean? And really, that's Aaron. So Aaron saw the situation here, and he made a quick assessment of all the possible things I can do, what's the best thing I can do here? And his argument, he wanted to minimize the damage by dragging it out, hoping that Aaron Moshe would show up before the whole thing fell apart. Unfortunately, he was not fully successful, and it got out of hand. He was not, his strategy did not work, full. But here's going back to our initial the title of the class, which. Is a practical guide to battle the Satan. Basically, in order to not be rattled by life's conflicts, when people are coming down on you, or issues at the work, or problems with family members or relatives or friends, whoever they may be, the strategy really is to be a wise person, which we're breaking down. The initial stages is A, learn the principles of human psychology, which is expressed certainly in the Torah, Tanakh, Ethics of Our Fathers, Proverbs, and of course, in the last 200 years, it's been a tremendous explosion of insight. Many of the insights that the Chazal had themselves, but it's now a scientific discipline, or more toward a scientific discipline. That's the A. The B is to understand what are the principles animating ourselves. Or why do I feel the need to say that comment when that person says that? Why do I always fly off the handle when they say A, I always come in with B every time. What is that button that they're touching, that they're pressing? What is that button? And the third insight is, what are the mechanisms animating them? Why are they acting the way they do? Now, not to do this in real time when you're having the conflict, but when you are, let's say, using the Seder as the example, it's now a month before the Seder, okay? Or before it's going to be, before getting together for Mother's Day, Father's Day, you know, July 4th, whatever is the, or whatever the situation is going to be, that's going to be a source of anticipated conflict. See, Aaron did not go crazy because he was a person who was a wise person, and therefore he was able to stay grounded, assess the situation, figure out the mechanisms, and act appropriately. That's a tremendous skill set. That's why he's a leader. But everybody's a leader. The question is, who are you leading? Who are you having influence in? The first person you have to lead properly is yourself. Are you a person, are you leading yourself? Or do you feel leaderless? Do you feel that you're listing? You're drifting without direction? Always getting into the same problems with the same people every time. So these are the ingredients for a happier life. Study psychology. Understand my inner world. Understand the inner world of others. Understand the wisdom of the Torah which has so much to say about psychology and work and having relationships of excellence with all people. You know, to be able to effectively engage all people, besaver panim yafot, with a happy countenance. Not, it takes work. It takes study. It takes self-awareness. Why do people not do it? Because as going back to what Suzanne said, people do not know this. What I just shared with you today, on one hand, you can say, well, that seems pretty obvious. It's obvious, but people are unaware of that. And two, even if they are aware of that basic thing, it's very hard. You can even, the first thing to learn about human psychology in general, that's, you know, at least the basic, is kind of somewhat not, it's not so complicated. But what's really hard? What's the hardest knowledge to have?
Self-knowledge.
Self-knowledge. Very hard, because as Sigmund Freud had a nice line, and I say it all the time, but it's worth repeating. Every person's a genius when it comes to self-deception. We are geniuses at fooling ourselves. We think we know ourselves. We think we know. We think we're oftentimes in a little bit of a illusion or a delusion, and it takes work to be self-aware of the dynamics. You know, look, mankind. We're prone to making all kind. What the entire field of cognitive science have really identified is that man in general is very prone to making, you know, the same emotional mistakes all the time. You know what I mean? And people who know how to do, who know that, can take advantage of that. You know, there's all kinds of biases that we have that if you are know that, that's why salespeople who study psychology in our culture? People involved in sales. Because their job is to trying to, you know,
exploit those weaknesses to make money.
For somebody who is, you know, who is evilly minded, yes, that's the worst case scenario, is to take advantage of people, or better yet, is to be able to know how to develop rapport with all people, you know, and then hopefully not for evil, but it can be used for evil. Knowledge is power. It can be used for evil. But if you want to be happy, if you want a happy life, these are really what makes people miserable is so many conflict with family and friends and loved ones. know what I'm saying? It's very challenging. Not a simple area, you know, because again, you can't control the other people. You have to do all the movement. You know what I'm saying? You're the chess piece that has to move. You have to move around them. You can move them very little. So that really is the whole point. What I'm sharing with you tonight is that the flaw that the Jewish people had was that they were not wise people. And therefore, when Satan came, when the depression and anxiety hit them, they were done. They were crushed. And then it was in another emotion that was kind of like them to be gone. It was a complicated emotion. They were doubly done. You know what I'm saying? Aaron tried to help them, but he, even though he was a tremendously gifted in his skill set, he could not pull them out of this. You know, and look, it's easier to say that those guys are a bunch of losers. If I was there, I wouldn't have this problem. We should never assume that. We should assume that we're just going to be like everybody else. We're going to make the same mistakes. But at least we can learn from these mistakes. And that really is why the Torah records these the failures of the Jewish people as well, so we can learn to avoid them. And that really is being a wise person, self-knowledge, human knowledge of human psychology, understanding the dynamics of other people, and be able to achieve what Aaron tried to achieve, which is peace, to live peacefully with all people, whether they are emotionally appealing to you or you find them overwhelmingly annoying, because everybody has in your life overwhelmingly annoying people. It's not a hard challenge to get along with somebody who's very pleasant. That's not hard. What is it hard? To deal with an older person who's not changing, who is very annoying, controlling, demanding, irritating, obnoxious. That's where the skill sets really, you know, are tested. All right? That's my basic idea. The Parsha is robust. I mean, I can't. There's so much here. But I just wanted to open the door to understanding this area and then universalize it how we right now in 2018 can and have a better quality of life. That's the essential goal of tonight. All right, guys. Have a great night. I will see many of you tomorrow night at the MJE. And I want to say you guys all... have a Purim Sameach. Enjoy. Have a L'chaim for me, my friends.
All right, you too.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Bye-bye.
Take care.